And now, with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved, here is Dr. James Houck.
All right, everybody, good evening, wherever you are in the world at this time. It could be early evening, it could be late afternoon, it could be later evening. That's okay, but welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, finding one's courage to reclaim that which has always been in you. In fact, finding one's courage to reclaim that which you have always been. Yes, we are certainly eternal. And that's always been the message of reclaiming authenticity, just being able to, you know, have that courage to look at ourselves and discover new things about ourselves, but to, you know, first and foremost, discover who we have always been. And then what does that now mean for us to live that out as a soul? I am very excited to be with you here tonight, every other Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. I'm Dr. James Houck. Thank you for joining me this evening. And if you would like more information about me, or if you just want to leave me your comments about tonight's show, I invite you to visit that website. It's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. That is all one word right there. So www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. And if you would like to be part of the show, I invite you to call in. I will be taking your calls after the break, but that number is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And if you've been following me for some time, you know that each and every one of these broadcasts, you know, are dedicated to the integration of our spirituality and our mental health. And I place this integration all within the context of our relationships that we have with ourselves, others, and especially God or the divine. And in addition, these broadcasts are also cast in case you want to go back and listen again, or you can go back into the archives and listen to previous shows. Okay, so just visit the website and just click on where the archives section is and pull up any show that you would like to listen again and drop me a line. Let me know what you think of it. If you have any discussions, especially tonight's topic, if you have any discussions, please shoot me an email. I would love to engage with the audience and let's just carry on just a wonderful dialogue together. And, you know, as I did the last broadcast, I know that with this being the beginning of the year, a lot of people like to pop on and tune in to new podcasts that are out there. So if anybody is tuning in for the very first time, welcome aboard. And I just want to take a moment here just to share with you and everyone just where I'm coming from with these broadcasts, these podcasts. You know, I just want to share my two deep-seated beliefs that have really helped shape my outlook on reclaiming authenticity. And exactly where did I come up with that phrase? Well, the first one is that I truly believe that people have the answers within themselves. In other words, you know the kind of life you want to live. You know how you feel and what brings you peace and joy and hope. And you also know what doesn't. Okay? And I read an interesting quote earlier this morning. I just want to share it with you that part of this exploration is, you know, realizing what lies behind us and what lies before us are really tiny matters compared to what lies within us. So what lies behind us, what lies before us, these are tiny matters compared to what lies within us. And that is from the wonderful author Ralph Waldo Emerson. That's the first belief. The second belief is that I truly believe that everybody, I don't care who you are, everybody comes into this world with what they already need in this life in terms of their gifts, their talents, their skills, their graces, personalities, and so forth, or in other words, the very best parts of who you are. And yet, you and I both know that we often go through this life, and we can experience some pretty pleasant, but sometimes pretty unpleasant events. Or perhaps, you know, we just minding our own business, we find ourselves in the wrong place at the wrong time, and we may even end up suffering some pretty traumatic injuries. And even though we may have these experiences, there is always a tendency to stop believing that, well, how can I be going through these things if I am full of value, dignity, and worth? Or can I be going through these things and I feel like I need to hide my genuineness, my authentic self, because, well, once I've shared those things with others, they exploited them, or I was made fun of, or whatever it might be, okay? But either way, regardless of those things happening, we often end up going through life and living from a place of woundedness, where we're hiding the very best of who we are, instead of from a place of healing and wholeness, living our lives truly from the very best parts of who we are, truly living our lives from, you know, that perspective of who we are as a soul. And, you know, the reason for this is that, you know, some of these negative experiences, or even any experience that we take in through our five senses, you know, sight, sound, taste, touch, and smell. And even though we call these empirical evidences that we can measure, these are limited. And, you know, I'm sure you've told yourself, I've told myself through different times throughout my life that, well, you know, we believe that if we see it, well, then it must be true. Or if we can hear it, then it must be true. As well as other sensory-related experiences we believe to be the end-all, be-all truth. But as I just said, these sensory perceptions are limited, because what is taken in through the brain, you know, through these five senses, comes in through the brain. The mind also comes in and attempts to interpret what we have seen and heard and tasted, touched and smelled based on our limited experiences, not realizing that the holiest experiences are the ones that touch our soul. See, the full realization of who we are as souls liberates us. Even as Jesus himself stated that the truth shall set us free. And Jesus was pointing to a higher truth, that we are all souls connected to God since the beginning, and not exclusively, you know, we're not the end-all, be-all called the body, but also we embrace the fullness and the ability to live as souls in this world. Well, one of my favorite quotes comes from her book, A Return to Love. Marianne Williamson writes that we are all meant to shine as children are meant to shine. And we were born to make manifest the glory of God that is within us. It's not just in some of us, it's in everyone. And again, this is the whole point of reclaiming authenticity, helping people discover what has always been in them, as well as who you have always been as a soul. And, you know, as I will be talking about in this show, it's basically how we tell that story. You know, how do we share those stories from that perspective of we realize that we're a soul? You know, how do we tell some stories, you know, maybe from that place of woundedness at times, or from a place of disappointment? And depending on how long we may have been carrying around certain levels of brokenness, we might even tell our stories from a deeper place of bitterness or resentment. And yet, ironically, just as we experience woundedness in the context of relationships, it's also within the context of healthy and healthier relationships that we can find our healing, our voice, our authenticity. But the difficulty then is often finding the courage to discover that which has always been in us and who we are. You know, those gifts, those graces, those skills, and our uniqueness that we have come into the world with. One of my favorite words is achantos, Latin for a thisness. And this is something John Duns Scotus, the Scottish Franciscan, way back in the 1300s, just coined the phrase achantos, a thisness, a uniqueness to who we are, that no two people are alike, even though we may have similar experiences. No two people are alike because we have a thisness to us. We have a uniqueness, a chaotos. Because, again, I am a firm believer that, indeed, we do come into this world. We have everything we need for ourselves and for others. But through various experiences, we may have given away parts, if not the whole, of our uniqueness or our thinness. Now, this could be for a number of reasons, but perhaps, you know, one of these reasons is that we didn't feel as though we could ever live up to another person's expectation of us. Or maybe we even hid our uniqueness from ourselves or from others in order to survive an abuse. Or perhaps, you know, those aspects of ourselves may have been taken away from us, as back then we didn't have the strength to fight it. To say to the person who wants to take those things away from us that, no, my uniqueness belongs to me. I am not going to give that away because it is who I am. You're not entitled to that. You have your own uniqueness. Okay? But either way, when we become aware that we have done these things, all is not lost, okay? Because it does take tremendous courage to reclaim who we are. And we can reclaim our voice. We can reclaim our uniqueness. We can reclaim that thisness to us, our hachaiotos. And when this occurs, we soon discover that indeed we are going to begin to tell our stories, our life stories, from a different place inside of us, a place that is healed, a place that is whole, a place filled with gratitude. And our stories are worth telling because there is a freedom, a resiliency, an empowerment, and a wisdom that is shared through our lived experiences. Well, welcome to tonight's show. It's entitled, If Our Shoes Could Talk, Oh, the Stories They Could Tell. And before we get underway tonight, I just want to wish everybody who celebrates the Lunar New Year a happy Gong Hoi Fat Chao. Happy Chinese New Year. And interestingly, this particular Chinese New Year is the Year of the Snake, 2025, the Year of the Snake, which when you really get right down to it, you understand the characteristics of a snake. It's, you know, it's a symbol that, you know, represents a new beginning, a shedding of one's old skin, so to speak, much in the same way that a snake has to shed its own skin every now and then in order to continue living, in order to continue growing. Or in our case, letting go of what no longer serves us because you've outgrown it. And you want to take on something better, you know, something that will permit you to grow into a new sense of who you are. And likewise, you know, earlier this week on Monday, you know, January 27th, it also marked the observance of the International Holocaust Remembrance Day, which commemorates the victims of the Holocaust. And I believe we are up to, it's been 80 years since the Holocaust. Hard to believe. And, you know, this past Monday, you know, we remembered the day in which, you know, the killing of 6 million Jews, two-thirds of Europe's Jewish population, as well as millions of others killed by the Nazi regime and the collaborators all from the years 1933 to, I think, 1945. And just want to share with you real quick that recently I watched a very good film called Lee, L-E-E. Okay, that's it. That's the title, Lee. And it depicts one photographer's experiences during this time period. And Lee is a woman, a former New York City fashion model. And she was also an aspiring photographer living kind of, let's say, a bohemian lifestyle in Europe when she falls in love with Roland Penrose, Well, he later moves with Roland to London, and she gains employment with Vogue magazine during World War II. And she's busy photographing the Britons during the Blitz. And her ability to further document the war was really restricted because, well, we don't really have women doing that. But she didn't take no for an answer. Good on her. Because the United Kingdom disbarred women from serving anywhere near combat, you know. However, after the United States entered the war in late 1941, Lee is assigned as a war correspondent alongside the photojournalist David Sherman. And she is forever changed by what she witnessed and photographed for others to know what went on within the concentration camps. I mean, she goes in and, you know, I'm just going to go over here and I'm just going to take some pictures. You know, the concentration camps weren't cleaned out yet. So she got a firsthand account, and a lot of the pictures that we have of the atrocities we got from Lee. And so January 27th of every year, this is a year that's been, a date that's been selected by the United Nations General Assembly back in November of 2005. And the resolution came after a special session was held earlier that year on January 24th to mark the 80th anniversary of the liberation of the Nazi concentration camps and the end of the Holocaust. And there are hundreds upon hundreds of Holocaust memorials and museums throughout the world. And the two that I visited here in the United States were the Museum of Tolerance in Los Angeles, which also examined the racism and prejudices around the world. And the second museum I visited was the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. Now, at the beginning of taking the tour of the Holocaust Museum, you know, it's a self-guided tour. You just, you know, you pay your ticket and everything, and then you just walk through. There's three levels of it. You start at the top, and you just work your way down. At the beginning of that particular Holocaust Museum tour in Washington, you're given a passport with a picture of an individual who was once held at the concentration camps. And I remember going through these three levels that just were strewn with stories, newspaper headlines, clippings, pictures, political speeches, videos of all the inhumane experiments and the atrocities that led up during, you know, 1935, 1945 in Nazi Germany. And to say that it was quite emotionally overwhelming doesn't even touch it. I mean, several times I had to collect myself. It was just that, you know, you're just inundated with everything. And it was very common to see people just break down and cry or just hold and try to comfort one another. And yet the part of that self-guided tour that really tied my stomach in knots was when I came to a large room that was filled with mounds and mounds and mounds of shoes. Shoes that were worn by the exterminated people. And they were piled high on both sides of the room that you walk through, and the fans were going because the smell was definitely getting overpowering. And I saw many people, again, staring at these shoes and just breaking down and weeping and sobbing and trying to comfort one another. Because for them and me, it finally hit home that every pair of these shoes represented a person. And I remember saying to myself, wow, I wonder what stories these shoes could tell, not just in how the person who owned them died, but rather, I wanted to know how they lived. Who were their families? Who were their friends? What occupations did they have? And so forth. Because, you know, behind every pair of shoes, there is a person. And behind every person, there's a story waiting to be told. And since there's a story waiting to be told, it's worth listening to, especially for the nuggets of wisdom contained in each and every one of the stories. Well, also, I was reminded of a festival called Guru Purnima. It's an Indian festival dedicated to offering respect to all the spiritual and academic gurus that one has had in his or her life. And it's celebrated as a festival in India, Nepal, and Bhutan by Hindus, Jains, and Buddhists. And this festival is traditionally observed to honor one's chosen spiritual leaders or teachers. And the custom of Guru Purnima holds a teacher high enough to remove ignorance from, let's say, a student's life, transcending him to a higher dimension. You know, it's that kind of knowledge that's imparted that there is transcendence and transformation. So Guru Purnima, or Purnima, I should say, serves as the ideal time to pay respects to your teachers, regardless of, let's say, what form they are in. Maybe they're here on earth now, or maybe they have long gone on before us. You know, teachers in our lives can really extend from our parents to academic masters to even elder siblings. And how this is lived out every day is by when you meet them, you bend down and you touch their feet to honor their spiritual path in this life and who they are as a soul. And as I mentioned earlier, this discovery of what lies within us is basically one of my deep-seated beliefs. Again, that everybody comes into this world already gifted with their skills and talents and personalities and strengths and so forth in order to discover, cultivate, and use to the benefit and healing of others. And down through history, often the greatest spiritual teachers and gurus are the ones who empower us to discover the potential of what lies within us. So a guru, let's say, a guru, a title typically found within Hinduism, is more than a teacher, because traditionally, the guru is just a revered figure to the student, with the guru serving as more of a counselor than, like, say, we understand in the West here what a teacher is. So they serve as a counselor, a guide who helps mold, you know, a student's values and shares experiential knowledge as much as just everyday literal knowledge. And they also serve as an exemplar in life, you know, one who is an inspirational source and who helps in the spiritual evolution of a student. And a guru is also one spiritual guide who helps a person to discover the same potentialities that the guru has already been transformed by. So whether it is within Western or Eastern cultures, effective teachers and mentors and leaders throughout history have always been characterized by those who help pull out of others the very best of themselves. In fact, they help us to be further healed and empowered to, yes, tell our stories differently. Because you see, the reason they're able to do this is because they're not going to allow anybody to settle for any kind of mediocrity in his or her life. Even if there's resistance on the part of the student or within younger generations, the guru is patient. The teacher is patient, knowing that each person is on his or her own spiritual journey. Because everybody arrives at their truth sooner or later. But, you know, effective teachers and mentors and leaders also empower others to discover greatness in themselves, as well as greatness in other people. And effective teachers and mentors and leaders never, never, ever, ever seek to control others. It's just the opposite. They seek to release. They seek to impart hope that we would then have the courage to embrace freedom, the freedom that takes us on our spiritual path a little bit further, takes us deeper into ourselves just a little bit more, and heals us to where we may feel stuck. So great teachers and mentors and leaders, they can do this because they themselves have discovered how to live in forgiveness and gratitude and love on a daily basis. Well, you know, sometimes we find an effective teacher or mentor or leader, and we often become, you know, let's admit it here, we often become complacent, maybe believing that all we need to do is just hang around them and ask for one blessing after another. But come on, let's not kid ourselves. We have to do our own spiritual inner work. You know, we have that work to do in terms of cultivating forgiveness in our life. And where am I ungrateful that I need to be living in more gratitude? And where do I need to love more in our daily lives? And, you know, this is what I have always sought out in my life. I have always sought out teachers who do more than just impart knowledge. Because if that's the case, I mean, truth be told, I can learn whatever I need to by reading a book. But that's not what an excellent teacher, guru, does. Rather, you know, I sought out teachers and gurus who have embodied what they have learned. You know, those who have so integrated their knowledge and experiences and so forth that it has transformed them into living as that soul. We do have to listen to our teachers and gurus and mentors and leaders, not to what they are saying, but also to their method of imparting that truth. And oftentimes, the most effective means of teachings come from people who are and were great storytellers. You know, from plots and analogies and irony, the great storytellers out there have always shared ancient wisdom that has ignited powerful transformation in those who have ears to hear, so to speak. And nothing touches our hearts and soul more as when an effective teacher shares a story. Because storytelling is one of the most basic and yet most powerful means of imparting truth. Because we take in those stories, not necessarily through our ears, but mainly we take in those stories in hearts. And it is those moments that we often feel that the moral of the story has reached in, grabbed us by the soul, and will never, ever let go. Well, I really want to hear what's on your heart about this subject. So if you'd like to, no pressure, but if you would like to call in, that number is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And I'll be taking your calls after this short break. Again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I'm your host, Dr. James Houck. I'll be back with you in 1 minute. Okay, welcome back. I told you it was a short break. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Well, let's see. In the first half of the show this evening, I was talking about how storytelling and listening to stories go hand in hand. And some people are better storytellers than others. Okay, let's face it, okay? Some stick to a well-rehearsed script, making sure every little detail is shared. And others just seem to be all over the place with their thoughts and leaving out important details and making up others. And you know how that is, okay? I'm sure there's people in the family who do that quite well. You don't know if they're telling the truth or they're, let's say, stretching the truth quite a bit. But you can always turn grandma or mom, and if you want the right story of what it's really like, okay? But nonetheless, we love great stories, and that's why they impact us so much. And yet, even though there are some who need to stick to a well-rehearsed script, or maybe there's that person to, they just kind of all over the place with their thoughts, you know, there are also others, you know, some people who have never shared the story of their lives with others. In fact, for some people, they have never been given a chance, or maybe they've never been given the permission to share those stories that lie deep within them. You know, the stories that are just buried deep underneath the emotional wounds and scars that they hide from the rest of the world. And when this occurs, helping people find their narrative empowers them to also find their healing. Well, narrative therapy is a style of therapy that I really like because it helps people become the intuitive expert in their lives. Storytelling. Okay? Because in narrative therapy, there is an emphasis on our stories that, you know, we've developed and carry with us throughout our lives. And narrative therapy is a form of therapy that actually views people as separate from their problems. Okay. And that's key. A lot of people, as they're telling stories, they're telling their own stories, can't make that distinction. You know, that if something wrong happened, you know, as a part of their telling their story or their experiences, they automatically consider themselves to be wrong or flawed or wounded in some way that's beyond healing. And that's not true. People are separate from their problems. You know, this is something that I was trained early on, you know, in this particular field, that whenever, you know, I started, you know, in counseling people who were in hospitals. And, you know, we were always cautioned not to reduce a person to their diagnosis. So you never say that, well, this, you know, this depressive case over here or this anxious case, you know, one filled with anxiety and so forth. No, it's address them by name. You know, Mrs. So-and-so who struggles with depression. Or Mr. So-and-so who struggles with anxiety and something. So to view people separate from their problems automatically restores the person's belief in themselves as one who is filled with value, dignity, and worth. Okay. Another example of this would be to help a person separate what has happened to them as an individual, you know, along with their interpretations and assumptions of, you know, what they think happened to them or who they see themselves as being, who, when you've heard me use this phrase before, how people drop an emotional anchor at a certain stage in their lives, like that's the end all be all of who they are because they cannot imagine moving forward, okay? Because all in all, you know, you might have done some pretty awful things in your life. But does that make you an awful person? No. You're a person who came into this world already equipped and graced with everything you need. But perhaps you have not recognized and embraced your fullest potential. And therefore, you are a person with value, dignity, and worth. There are also times when you may act in ignorance of it. We all have. There's a time that, let's say, we've walked in darkness, and then all of a sudden things became clear to us. And we started to see ourselves as that person of value, dignity, and worth. And we had to work through our issues of self-forgiveness, of the things that we have done while walking in that ignorance of who we truly are. And, you know, part of our healing from our past not only involves telling our stories, but it also involves reclaiming our empowerment to rewrite our stories that are now life-empowering and affirming. And, you know, don't get me wrong here. We don't achieve this empowerment from, let's say, an embellished, delusional view that nicely ties up stories in a bow. No, it's not that kind of rewriting our story, because there's actually three benefits to this narrative therapy. One, in narrative therapy, place any untold or unspoken moments in a person's life into his or her current story. In other words, a person's past has an effect on how they see themselves today. And this is something that I had a couple of different conversations with folks today on, just in just listening to how people tell their stories, and not just listen to the words and the metaphors that are being used, but also listen for what's not being said. And in fact, I have one colleague who takes that even further. She will listen to the words, and she'll also listen for what's not being said, but she'll also listen in between the words, you know, the pauses where people take a breath, where they sigh, where do they tear up? And so on and so forth. Okay. She does a beautiful job with that. Okay. So again, part of our healing from our past not only involves telling our stories, but also involves reclaiming our empowerment to rewrite our stories that are life empowering and affirming. Okay. So the first one is to place any untold or unspoken moments of a person's life into his or her current story. The second is that this method, this narrative therapy, also helps people connect to the emotional content and retell their stories from both a head and heart center. And I'm sure you've heard this before. You can tell when a person's just telling the story from their head. It's almost as if they report, you know, nothing but the facts. But where's the emotional content? Where are they in the story? And third, you know, narrative therapy also helps people construct new perspectives and new insights in relation to how they tell their stories. Okay, again, it's not a rewriting of the story, leaving out, you know, key aspects, but it's how you tell the story, which is now life empowering and affirming. Okay, and again, this is what makes effective teachers and sages and gurus and leaders, is that they know how to enter into another person's life story, and they become part of it, and they transform the person into embracing who they are and the potential for them to be something they may even have yet to realize. And this is a prominent theme that emerges time and time again when people not only find the power of their voice, but also listen to the empowerment of others. Did you get that? We not only find the power of our voice, but we also listen to the empowerment of others. Because other people, they too will find their voice. And when they do that, they're never the same. We're never the same. You know, it's like a sound of thunder when they speak. And this is often the case with anybody who have gone through any kind of trauma or an event in their life in which a person's assumptions have been completely shattered. You know, that innocence is lost. What I used to take for granted in this world, gone. How I used to look at the world and myself, gone. Because finding and reclaiming our voice following something traumatic takes time, but it can be done. The greater the integration, the more powerful the transformation. And, you know, the key element in finding and claiming and using your voice will have an effect on your brain. Guaranteed. Guaranteed. Because in the world of science, you know, they call this brain plasticity or neuroplasticity, a rewiring of the brain. You know, and this was something that in the 90s, which was coined the decade of the brain, neuroplasticity really came to the forefront, not just in research, but also effective ways of helping people kind of rewire their brain. Okay. And you know, basically, neuroplasticity allows the neurons, you know, or the nerve cells in the brain to compensate for, let's say, a physical injury or disease, and to adjust their activities in response to new situations or to any kind of, let's say, changes in their environment. And there's an old saying out there in, you know, the field of neuroscience that neurons that are wired together fire together. Okay. And this means the more you run, like, say, a neural circuit in your brain, the stronger that circuit becomes. Okay. And this is why, to quote another old saying that's out there, that practice makes perfect. And we do this through not only reinforcing muscle and cell memory, but we also rewire our brain. If we can see ourselves doing it, more than likely, it's going to happen. So in layman's terms, it means that the brain can relearn how to process what it sees and what it hears and what it tastes and what it touches and what it smells and speak and send signals to the muscles so that people can learn how to walk again or learn how to speak. You know, the ability to learn new things and enhance your existing cognitive capabilities, let's say, and even helps people recover from strokes and traumatic brain injuries. Well, if you've ever seen the movie, The King's Speech, a great, great movie, highly recommended. It stars Colin Firth, Helen Bonham Carter, and Geoffrey Rush. And it's based on a you know, historical account of King George VI. And he had a severe speech impediment. You know, he stuttered. Okay, and this is from early childhood. And he retained his brain to control, his brain to control his stuttering problem as he got older in life. And, you know, certainly research in this area has also given hope to millions of people. Okay, because, you know, for parents of, let's say, special needs children, you know, neuroplasticity has demonstrated how we can use speech and language therapy to improve communication and curb behavioral challenges. And musicians, they know all about neuroplasticity because it also helps reinforce their experience-dependent neuroplasticity. So in other words, when you learn to play an instrument, you're involving both the left and right brain synchronically. And music therapy is an excellent way for people to rewire their brain activity, especially when it comes to reading and playing music at the same time. Okay. And another good example of neuroplasticity is learning a new language. Okay. Anybody out there know 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different languages? Okay. Let's just stay with 2. Okay. You know, when you're learning a new language, you know, when somebody is learning a new language, the neurons that fire in the brain that are responsible for language production are often connected with the sounds of that language or recognizing pictures associated with the language itself. So this is what makes, you know, immersion programs so effective. So you who are fans of Rosetta Stone or other language programs that integrate sights and sounds with prominent nouns and verbs and common phrases often learn more easily than just sound repetition alone. Well, let's circle back here for a little bit and just how stories are told. You know, our brains are just fascinating. You know, and we're just hardwired to tell stories. And as a boy, I'm sure if you've been following me for some time, you've heard me tell this story many times. But as a boy, I remember listening to the same family stories at picnics and holidays and other family gatherings. And after a while, I heard these accounts so often that by the time I was an early teenager, I could recite them word for word. And, you know, now with the benefit of hindsight, I also understand that not only did these details of how a story was told, how those details did not change, but also the storyteller's interpretations and attitudes remained the same. You know, in the stories that I heard, there was always this underlying tone of helplessness or bitterness, or sadness and resentment that would often drive how the story was being told. And it's quite ironic. When I first learned this, you know, it was almost as if the story was not being told correctly, if these negative emotions were absent in the story itself. And, you know, try this. Next time you get together with your family, just listen. Listen to how family stories are told. And yes, facts and figures and names and places are important, but what's even more significant is how we tell our stories. You know, the words we use are often filled with symbols and metaphors. And these could be positive symbols or negative metaphors. You know, they could be affirming or frightful, and they're often filled with emotions and very, very powerful, rich images. And in counseling others struggling with intergenerational trauma, I have noticed that when people have not been able to transform, say, the negative energy around tragic events, their stories are told the same each time, every time. But when healing occurs within the greater context of generations, people tell their stories much differently from a healthier, more holistic place. Okay, because the reason why people can tell their stories differently is because much of the healing involves becoming aware of the former negative perceptions and the negative self-talk that no longer serves them. Okay, in other words, we begin to recognize how these cognitive schemas, just the negative self-talk or the negative perceptions, how these have been draining our energy, or how these are, you know, distort our perceptions and even diminish our potential for healthier relationships. But when we replace these with more transformative and life-giving perspectives, there's a starburst of energy that goes out from us that heals all generations across time and space. And yet when this happens in the ordinary, or allowing room for the extraordinary acts of God in the everyday ordinary aspects of our lives, this should give us heed to pay attention, to have this awareness, and to strive for more of the understanding. Because when we discover these unhealthy perspectives and these unhealthy attachments, we can also go a little bit deeper, deeper within ourselves to discover the root causes of our, let's say, unforgiveness, or our pain, our bitterness, and woundedness. And this is where the inner work of unforgiveness, lack of gratitude, and bitterness begins. How do we tell our stories? And here's the cool thing about it, because whenever we begin to heal from these experiences and we discover the root causes of our unforgiveness, pain, and bitterness, and so forth, when we begin to heal from those things, our stories, our family stories, our intergenerational stories are now told from a healthier perspective. They're told from a place of one's inner peace and wholeness. You know, we're always going to remember facts and figures, but as we go along the stories, there's going to be a but. You know, so-and-so did this, and this is how they lived their lives, but let's talk the present generations. Let's talk future generations. Because we've healed from this as a family, and now our lives are going in a different trajectory, or whatever it might be. Okay, there's always a part two to the stories that were once told from an unhealed place in ourselves. Because after we find the healing, There's always going to be a but. Okay. So just real quickly here, I know we have some limited time, but just think about your own stories for a minute. Think about how you tell them. Okay. Think about to whom you tell them. You know, who sits and listens to you? Think about the people who have caused you pain and disappointment and misery and heartbreak. Listen to the tone you use when you tell your story. Has anything changed from when you first started telling that particular story? But what if you told your story differently? What would change? Now, again, obviously, we cannot go back and rewrite history. But if what if we could change how we tell the story by inserting a different perspective or a wish? What would happen if, in thinking about the people in our stories, we would see them as wounded as well? What if we're able to see that instead of wishing them pain, we realize that they must have pain in themselves? And what if instead we wish them healing? Because that's what everybody really needs. How then would we tell our stories? I imagine we would be telling those stories from a more intuitive place within ourselves that has been awakened and blessed by its own transformation of that grace working in our lives. Okay. Well, I'm Dr. James Houck, and you have been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Yes. How we can heal through storytelling is that we can go back and retell our stories after a while. Our memories of that experience will stay the same, but our perspectives will change, now told from a healthier place in us. Thank you for spending this hour with me. And again, I invite you to visit the website, leave me your comments about tonight's show. And until we spend this hour in 2 weeks again, everybody be safe, everybody behave yourselves, and everybody keep telling your stories from that healthier place in you. Good night.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding around to buy a book by Dr. Houck, it's all there. Just wander over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 6 p.m. Pacific, on BBS Radio TV.